Welcome back to Current State. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We have a great show for you today. Lansing City Council member Carol Wood joins us in a few minutes to talk about next year's budget, which was refreshingly without sound and fury getting passed here on Monday night. That's not always the case, but we'll review how the city will be spending $118 million here in fiscal year 2015 in just a few minutes and talk about other city business, the Board of Water and Light, and challenges being faced by the Lansing School District as well with Ms. Wood. Also, after that, we're going to get to know two acquaintances of the late Michael Otto. Michael was the pharmacist who was shot to death at the Rite Aid Pharmacy in Frandor last Monday, and we're going to be talking also with the head of Lansing's Regional Sister Cities Commission. You may recall that one of Lansing's sister cities is in Ghana, which was Michael Otto's native country. And so there are people working together here to get Mr. Otto's body back to Ghana. Our Sister Cities Commission is involved, and we'll talk with two acquaintances of the late Michael Otto here later this hour on Neighbors in Action here on WKAR. At the top of our program today, on November 29th, 1966, 28 men lost their lives on Lake Huron when the freighter, the Daniel J. Morrell, broke apart in a storm. One man survived, and he joins us on Current State today. Dennis Hale is in Lansing to talk about his new book, Shipwrecked, Reflections of the Sole Survivor, and we welcome Dennis Hale to Current State.
Good morning.
Good to be with you.
Same here.
How old were you, and how long had you been working as a sailor when you had your experience on board the Morrell?
Well, that was my third year. I was 26 years old, and I loved sailing. It was a great life.
And the ship was 60 years old in 1966.
But, you know, that was the average age of all the ships that were sailing at that time.
Okay.
They built a lot of ships in 1912.
So you didn't. What happened in 1912 to trigger all the construction of those ships?
Steel, I guess.
Steel? Okay.
Demand for steel.
You had no doubts then about the seaworthiness of the Morrell when you got on board?
I never questioned that, no.
Okay. Had you been on board the boat before?
No.
No, that was your first time on the boat.
First time.
Well, take us back to that day, if you would, Dennis. November 29th, 1966. How did it start out?
Well, I missed the boat in Lackawanna when we were unloading at Bethlehem Steel, and I had to catch it at Mullins Fuel Dock in Windsor. And I climbed aboard, and I went to sleep, and I got up. I worked a 4-to-8 watch, 4 in the evening till 8 in the evening, and 4 in the morning till 8 in the morning. And so I got up on time to do my 4 o'clock watch. And it was a normal watch, nothing exciting happening, no bad weather reports coming over the radio, nothing. At 6 o'clock, I relieved the wheelsman, and he went back to eat his dinner and came forward, and then I went back. He got back about, 7:30, I guess. No, 6:30. And then I went back to eat dinner and came forward. I did notice as I was going back and coming forward again, there was some spray coming over the bow, but nothing alarming. At 8 o'clock, my watch was over. I went back to get the first mate, my boss, something to eat.
Sorry, this is 8 a.m.
No, 8 p.m.
This is 8 p.m.
Yeah.
Okay.
And went back to get my first mate something to eat as well as a wheelsman, and stopped and talked to the wheelsman for a while. He said, "Well, Dennis," he says, "easy trip. We go up to Taconite Harbor, load, turn around, go back to Lackawanna, tie up. 3 days later, we get off the boat for the season." I said, "Yeah, but, you know, November's notorious." He says, "You were in the pilot house. Nothing serious coming over the radio." I said, "Yeah, I know, but you can never tell." His room was on the spar deck, the working deck, the main deck. And mine was, too. Mine was two doors down from his. So I went to my room, stripped down in my undershorts, grabbed a book, jumped in bed, and I probably read till 10:30, turned out my bunk light, and went to sleep. Sometime later, I was awakened by a loud bang. And in my slumber, I guess I just thought it was the anchor on the bow or something, hitting the bow. And I rolled over. Then there was another loud bang, and this time all the books came off my bookcase. Well, that never happened before, so I decided I'd better get up. As I pulled the curtains from around my bunk, the general alarm sounded, and I could look up on the wall, and see where the hammer was hitting the bell. I could see sparks coming from it. I jumped out of bed, grabbed my life jacket, put that on, went out in the companionway to the main deck. And as I did that, another fella, Al Wimmey, was coming out of the middle room, and he got to the opening before I did, and he said, "Oh, my God, oh, my God." And I said, "What is it, Al? What's wrong?" And he said, "Oh, my God," and rushed back into his room. I stepped out onto the main deck and looked towards the stern. There was no stern there. The ship was hogged, and the bottom was gone out of it. And it was still...
What does that mean? The bottom had been taken out of your ship? Or?
Well, it had broken, but the ship was actually in about a 60-degree angle to the stern.
Okay.
Or maybe not even that much, maybe 20, 30 degrees. And I couldn't see the stern at all. I could see lights that were illuminated the stack. I could see lights coming up from there, but no stack. Eventually, it did come back up. I walked over to the crew's war call. There were four guys in there. One of them, Norm Bragg, was on the sinking of the Steinbrenner. And I know I kind of looked up to him for direction, you know. And we talked about what was going on, what was happening, what was going to happen. And then he said, "Well, fellas," he says, "we better go back and get on the raft." Now, the raft was probably maybe 150 feet down the deck from where I was standing. At this point, all I had on was a pair of undershorts and a life jacket, and I decided to go back into my room for more clothing. With that first explosion, I guess you could call it, it severed all the electricity coming forward, so we had absolutely no lights in the forward end of the ship. The only way I found my room was I held out my right hand and counted the doorways till I got to my door. Went inside, searched around for more clothing, but all I could find was a pea coat. I put that on over the life jacket and came out onto the companionway and out onto the deck. It must have been snowing that night because I had ice and snow coming up between my toes as I walked back. I climbed aboard the raft behind a guy named John Groh, and he had a heaving line, a rope, and he was tying himself down to the raft, as was Norm Bragg. Well, I didn't want to go back up forward and get a rope, and I didn't want to be tethered to anything in case I had to move real quick. That night, we had 30, 35-foot seas, 65-mile-an-hour winds, a water temperature of 44, and an air temperature of 33.
Were you ever in the water before you got on the raft?
Or, no. Or, okay, no, this so. Was this was as it sat on the ship. And then... there was conversation about other ships being in the area and to make sure that we fired off some flares once we got into the water and back onto the raft. I was facing the port side, which meant the bow was to my right, and I looked up there, and I could see the second mate by his door fumbling around with something, and I kept thinking, come on down here with the rest of us, you know. And then I heard a noise coming from the stern, and I looked towards the stern, and they had lights back there. And this one oiler, Don Worcester, was standing in front of him, had an oil can in his hand. You could tell it was Don because of his build. He's a big guy, not fat, but muscular and tall. And I saw him, and I took my eyes off him for a second and looked back, and he was gone. But then I heard another noise, and I looked over my shoulder to the starboard gun wall. That's where the deck meets the side of the ship. And the main deck was starting to tear. That's 1-inch overlapping steel plate. And it just tore real slow like a piece of paper. And you could see sparks coming from it every once in a while. And then a puff of dust, probably where it hit a rivet, and the rivet went flying. I watched it tear all the way up to the hatch combings. And then you could hear it tearing between the hatches. And when it got to the port side, the two sections separated. And somehow it moved itself around to where the stern section, still under power, was abreast of the bow. And from where I sat, I was looking right into the cargo hold of the Morrell as it advanced towards us. When it got fairly close, I closed my eyes and just held on, you know.
The boat had broken in half.
Oh, yeah. It broken in half. Both sections had separated. As I sat there watching in advance, as soon as it got close enough to where I thought it was going to hit us, I just closed my eyes and held on to the steel bar, and the next thing I knew, I was in the water. I believe maybe one of those 35-footers may have hit us and washed everything overboard. Fortunately, I landed on the same side that the raft was on. Being tossed overboard, I don't know how far in the water I was, but I couldn't even tell which way was up. Forgetting I had a life jacket on, I let some air out so I could follow the bubbles to the surface. Once I got to the surface, I looked around and I couldn't find the raft. Now, the raft is equipped with a carbide light. It's a canister about that, about, 7 inches around and probably a foot tall. And it's got a pin that goes through it that's welded to the deck. And when the raft goes overboard, this canister goes with it, and that pin comes out. As soon as the carbide gets wet, it ignites. And that's what I was looking for, and I couldn't find it at first. And finally, I saw it between a couple waves. Now, when I say 35-foot waves, every wave wasn't a 35-footer. You'd get 4, 5, 6-footers, maybe longer than that. And then once I saw the raft, there was no one on it. And by the time I got to it, there were two men aboard, John Cleary and Art Stojek. They helped boost me aboard the raft. And I told them, I said, we got to get into the compartment in the middle of the raft. This is just a flat 2x4 raft. It's got metal superstructure and a couple canisters holding something buoyant in it.
And some of those men on that raft did not survive.
I was the only survivor out of 20.
You were it. And there were how many of you all together?
There were four of us on the raft, and then there was a crew of 29.
What was that like, being with those people who died?
Well, you go through a lot of different things out there. You go through what you call a loss of faith syndrome, where you really don't care if you live or die. You just want this whole traumatic thing to end.
Yeah.
And I just kept hoping I could make it and praying to die, basically, just to get it over with.
We're talking with Dennis Hale, the sole survivor of the wreck of the Daniel J. Morrell from November 29th, 1966, on Lake Huron. At some point, Dennis, you realized you had a chance. What happened?
Well,
did a boat appear? Did a plane fly overhead?
Helicopter. That was after 38 hours out there. 14 hours later, the other three guys were gone. And then I made it another 24 hours, and I saw the helicopter, and I waved to them. And by that time, the raft itself was on the beach, basically, in the water. And I could feel it hitting the bottom of the beach. And I was there for like 24 hours. I waved to them, and then they landed, and two of the Coast Guardmen, I saw them walking through the water to come to me. And they picked me up and laid me on my back on top of one of the other bodies. And they asked me if I had any injuries. And I said, no, I think I have some broken ribs. I just wanted to get off the raft. I didn't have any broken ribs.
How did it feel, though, to realize you were probably going to survive this? Do you remember that feeling of seeing that copter and knowing that they had seen you?
Yeah. The first thing I said to them was, I love you guys. I love you guys. Where the hell you been? And they told me that the ship hadn't been reported missing for 34 hours.
Why do you think you survived? You certainly weren't wearing much by the way of protective clothing.
No, I had undershorts, a life jacket, and a pea coat. There are a number of reasons. I think my faith, for one. Secondly, when I got out of bed and I put that life jacket on, that was Kapok wrapped in a heavy plastic. And then they tell me a pea coat, no matter whether it's wet or dry, is good insulation. So there's a number of reasons why I think I made it.
Where were you geographically when you got into the lifeboat? Were you miles and miles from shore?
We were 18 miles north-northeast of the tip of the thumb.
18 miles north-northeast of the tip of the thumb.
Then the raft drifted back onto the thumb, right near Harbor Beach.
For many years, you didn't talk about the wreck.
Yeah.
How did your life unfold after that?
Well, I was going through survivor guilt, and I just had a lot of problems. I didn't want to be the survivor. I just wanted my old life back. I just wanted to be Dennis Hale. And after 24 years, there were things I wanted to say. I had an afterlife experience while I was out there, and I wanted to talk about that. And I decided, it's time. I didn't decide. People in Whitefish Point decided, they weren't there then. The Steamship Historical Society, Shipwreck Historical Society,
right,
had me come in and give a presentation, first presentation. And after I did that, I really felt relieved. I felt like a weight was off my shoulders. And then
so it was right for you to be silent for some number of years, but then the time came for you to actually address this.
Yes.
Okay. Have you been to the site of the wreck?
Yes.
What was that like?
It was emotional. Very emotional. And, you know, there's a line attached to the mast of the wreck. And there's a like a bleach bottle attached to that that floats on the top of the water. And I actually held on to that rope, and I felt the connection there. So it was really, really different.
You have written a book about your experience to get even more of this
Well, I've written a book. I've written an autobiography because I have lived a very strange life. Very strange.
Do you feel you've reached some point of healing here with this?
Oh, yeah.
It would appear you have.
Well, about 5 years ago, I started going to a psychologist, and he helped me an awful lot, not just with the shipwreck, but my life before the shipwreck. And it made it possible for me to face all the bad things I thought about. Of course, when I wrote the book, I might write something that's that hurt me to talk about. And I put the book down for a few days or a few weeks or a few months, and then get back to it.
Did you avoid the water after this experience for some period of time?
Yeah, I vowed I'd never sail again. But then in 1999, I was offered a trip on the Roger Blau, and they let me bring 7 friends with me, and we went aboard and had a really good time.
That was your first time on the water since 1966?
Yep.
And that was what year?
That was 1959.
59. Well,
no, 69.
69.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
3 years later.
No, it was 20 some years. Wait, 99.
Oh, 99.
99, yeah.
66 to 99.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've been out since then on other boats, not freighters. I've been on the Badger several times. I was on the John Brown in Baltimore. And I feel comfortable.
This extra life experience that you had, how did you process that in the years after that?
I knew what had happened to me. I had a bad response from a priest, and I just dealt with it.
Are there still things after all these years that are the occasional physical reminders of what you went through when a storm blows up? I mean, does the
wreck
always cross your
every
mind?
Step? I've had so much problems with my feet. I've lost the side of my foot and 4 toes, and all I have is a big toe, and it has a prosthesis in it. I've had 1 surgery on 3 toes on my right foot, all residual effects of frostbite, and because of the problem with my left foot, my right knee went out on me. And I have a prosthesis in my knee.
Another well-known Great Lakes shipwreck is the Carl Bradley. Yeah. The Bradley went down in Lake Michigan in 1958. The Bradley had 2 survivors, one who died in 1970. The other, Frank Mays, was also in his 20s, like you were at the time of the wreck. Have you two ever crossed paths?
Oh, yeah, we see each other at least once a year, yeah. As well as the guys from Cedarville. When I leave here tomorrow morning, I'll be going to Roger City. One of the survivors from the Cedarville has a home that's completely furnished, it's vacant. And when I'm in the area, I stay there. And then from there, Friday, I'll go up to Whitefish Point.
What was it like first meeting Frank Mays? I mean, you guys are, you know.
Well, you know, it was kind of funny. You know, even the guys from the Cedarville, they don't talk about it.
What is Cedarville?
Another ship that went down.
Okay.
But they don't talk about it, which I think is wrong. I mean, you've got all these feelings inside that need to be released, at least as far as I was concerned. Frank, too. He needs to talk more.
And you advise him to do that?
Yeah.
So few people have been in the position you are in, the only survivor of a shipwreck. Do you find that with your speaking engagements and books that people have stories of their own trauma that they want to share with you?
Yeah.
Does that happen?
Yep. I got one today from a woman who heard me talk last night. And
what kinds of things do you hear? I'm curious.
Oh, that God saved me, that they had family members who had similar incidents, not on the water, but, you know, through the war, and just people that really enjoy hearing me talk.
What happened today?
Today?
You said somebody shared something.
Oh, I got an email from this woman that heard me talk last night, and she was talking about the hardships her father had. So, that you know, it's I guess that's what I'm about.
Well, it has been fascinating to hear your firsthand story, and we really appreciate it. Dennis Hale is the sole survivor of the 1966 Lake Huron shipwreck of the Daniel J. Morrell. Mr. Hale, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Dennis Hale will talk about his experiences tonight at the Capital Area District Library Downtown Branch on South Capitol Avenue in Lansing at 7 p.m. This morning at 10, he'll be at the CADL Leslie Branch on Pennsylvania Street in Leslie. It's Current State on WKAR. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Lansing City Council approved a 2015 fiscal year budget totaling $118 million on Monday night. The budget debate was less intense than in recent years since the city did not face a deficit. Here to review what's in next year's budget and to discuss other business, including a planned move by the LPD and other city-related business, Council Member Carol Wood. Hi, Carol.
Hi, good morning.
This was the first Lansing budget since 2005 without a deficit, a nice break from tradition for you?
Absolutely. You know, we have watched declining services as well as vacant positions not being filled and reducing our workforce. And as many of the listeners understand, you know, we are a service organization. And so we produce a service. And without those people to do it, that means less is being done for them in their neighborhoods.
Did that actually free up time for you to focus on other issues that in past years you've been preoccupied with how to close a deficit?
Well, as your listeners might not know, when the mayor does bring us a budget, it is balanced. So what we're looking at are the choices that he's made to balance that budget. And we look and determine whether that's the way we want to have that budget balanced. And are there other ways? You know, I think this budget allowed us a little more time to look at how we were budgeting for the future. We went through some fiscal sustainability classes that actually the chamber asked us to be involved in along with MSU. We did those in March. We spent almost 10 hours going over other communities' budgets and long-range plans and how many communities are looking at budgets on a multi-year facet from anywhere from 2 to 5 years, looking at our capital improvement budget and looking at how other communities are putting that together with making sure that there are responses as to what those capital improvements will do and how in the long term you're making judgments to spend those dollars. So it wasn't just a matter of just looking at the budget. It was looking at new ideas for budgeting in the future.
Sounds like a constructive experience.
It was, you know, and I think one of the things that we took from that was, again, looking for best practices for capital capital improvements. We received a great deal of information about other communities, and some of the best practices is justifying the need for the project, explaining the relationship to other projects, the cost of submitting the total package, detailed budget, estimating what the annual income would be, or the estimating the operating costs. You know, sometimes we'll say we're going to add a portion of a river trail, but are we asking ourselves what will be the long-term upkeep of that? And when we're looking at replacement values, have you put that in the budget for the future? And so those were some of the questions that we were asked to really look at. Again, looking at projections of revenues as well as expenses for the next 5 years and seeing what trends are out there.
It's a multi-year mentality, more so than in the past.
More so than in the past. You know, we have been having to deal with, again, as you started the top of the show with, cuts year after year after year, and you were trying to figure out where to make another cut. Now what we're looking at is, if you stay stable, what are some of the things that you can look at as the economy starts to increase?
Perhaps because there was less debate on the budget, a couple of other items at Monday night's meeting were addressed at some length. You and Jody Washington were the only two on the council voting against a proposal moving the Lansing Police Department's North Precinct operation to the Hill Center. What don't you like about that?
Well, first of all, I think we talked about it just a few minutes ago. One of the things that we were asked to do as part of the budget process with the capital improvements was ask a series of questions. You know, we have spent a great deal of taxpayer dollars renovating the South Precinct as well as the North Precinct. These are rental properties that we're walking away from. Those are taxpayer dollars. We're looking at also doing renovations on the Hill Center. Again, taxpayer dollars. We have spent $187,000 on a study. We were given a copy of the work plan. That work plan is 25 pages. Now, if I got paid that kind of money per page, I'd be out there doing studies all over the place. But those were questions, along with where in the budget is a consolidated plan for moving forward. None of those things were addressed. Is the Hill Center the best place for right now? Without having that background and understanding where we were going in the future are the reasons why I voted no.
So two piecemeal of an approach to the future is your concern. Still, you were outvoted on this. What's the sentiment? Clearly, there's some support for this.
Well, and again, I think the issue was, but with other council members, was to trust the administration that they would come up with a plan within the next 3 to 4 years. You know, I go back and I'm looking at a budget that was given to us by the mayor and for our FY 2013 budget, where he actually talks about moving us to the South Washington Armory and spending $450,000 on capital improvement. You know, that was an FY 13, and now we're in an FY 15, and some of the same things that he was asking for are not part of the plan today. At the last minute, I do admit that the person who owns the North Precinct made an offer to the city of a rent-free for a year. That's a savings of $300,000. You know, one of the things that we were talked about during our budget process was putting more money in the rainy day fund. Would it have made more sense to stay there an additional year with that savings and added that to the rainy day fund? You know, I think those are all questions that we did not have an opportunity to sufficiently address before voting on in the budget.
But for now, the move is a done deal.
For now, it is done. It was
to
supported.
The Hill Center from, yes, from North Precinct.
Correct.
Our guest is Carol Wood, a longtime city council member in the city of Lansing. We're talking about the new budget and other city business. There's another topic that the council spent a lot of time on Monday evening, and that's whether to change a city ordinance that would allow alcohol sales at the city's Hope Soccer Complex. There appears to be quite a bit of support for this. Backers, including the mayor, say it'll be good for attendance. Where do you stand?
I have some concerns about this. Part of my concern is that we're looking at a venue that is primarily geared toward children. We have heard stories over and over again about enthusiastic parents when their children are involved in sporting activities and how sometimes that can be volatile. Adding alcohol to that mix is a great concern of mine. You know, one of the things that was discussed when this plan first came to us was a concern about a smoke-free environment and changing that complex to smoke-free. Well, I figure if you're concerned enough about a smoke-free environment, then why are we going to alcohol?
Onto the budget itself. No personnel cuts. In fact, the city will be adding three new positions, another city attorney, a social media person, and a human relations staffer. Were these all justified new hires in your view?
The majority of them were. I am a social media person, and I believe in the importance of doing social media. I just believe that that should have been something that handled by the departments. I'm not sure that there was necessarily a need. We have City TV that could have been something that could have been done through there as well. But
whose social media will this person be handling? Is it just anything and everything, or is it?
Well, that's a good question. It will be housed in the mayor's office. So not sure what that means and how the departments will interact with that and how they'll be putting out that media. But again, right now, this is under the mayor's line item, and it will be one of his staffers.
Did the city need another person in the legal department?
Over the years, positions became vacant, what we ended up doing was removing them from the org chart instead of filling those positions, especially as we talked about early on with the budget. It was not a decision to fill those positions. So based on that, I think that there is a need to fill that position in the city attorney's office. It allows us to do more work inside instead of asking outside firms to do some of that contract work. And so it's important to make sure that we have the resources to represent the city.
And a human relations staffer, what will that person be doing?
Being a right-hand person for Joan Jackson Johnson, and as many of us know in the community, she's out there doing a great deal with our homeless, with those that have many needs out there, and because of that in our community, she needs that additional help.
Dollars well spent, in your view.
And that place, yes, dollars definitely well spent. We'll also, we're also in the budget having a cadet program, and the importance of a cadet program with the police department is the fact that we're getting young people involved in police work that will eventually end up going to the LCC Academy, and then we will have an opportunity to hire them, and making that transition from when an officer leaves to having a new officer on board less cumbersome. Some and having some homegrown people involved in our police department.
The city will spend $1.5 million on local roads next year and at least $370,000 on sidewalks. Are those dollars well spent?
Absolutely, and anybody that's driven on our roads understands that we need much more than those dollars that were allocated. If I had my way, I wish we could have bonded for some dollars to add to that for our roads. But again, you got to be able to pay for those bonds. When we're looking at our sidewalk infrastructure, we have many areas that need repairs, as well as what we're doing is calling gap closures. That's where you have sections of the city where you have a sidewalk at one end and a sidewalk at another and a space in between, and we're filling those gap closures.
Now, do you know how and where that $1.5 million will be spent?
Not at this time. What we do is we have a PACER rating that looks at both our sidewalks as well as our roads, making a determination of where things need the most work done at a particular time. In looking at that, there are preventative measures that we could be dealing. Crack sealants. There are a grinding process where you just take off the top layer of a road and put down new asphalt. If you go down to a roadbed and are reconstructing an entire road, you're looking at $1 million a mile.
Now, is $1.5 million on local roads, is that more than in a typical year?
Yes, it is a little more than in a typical year.
A little bit more.
Okay. A little bit more.
Okay. What are the odds the city could again avoid a deficit situation in a year? Are there just too many bridges to cross between now and then? Or, I mean, you've been at this a while. Do you think you could face another zero deficit situation next year?
Well, I think it would depend on what's happening out in the worldwide economy for us to understand that. When we're looking at the state and we're seeing that property values are going up, we received about $500,000 more this year in income taxes than what was projected. We're seeing an incline in revenues. Will that continue? We have to see what the world economy is doing and how that effect will have on us. You know, one of the things that are in the news today are additional recalls with GM. How that will affect our bottom line will be extremely important.
What do you make of that? 1.34 million manufactured at Delta Township.
Well, the important thing is, one, to make sure that people are driving safe vehicles. The thing is, are they going to lose faith in the product? And that's going to be the thing that GM has to continue to work on. We believe it's a good product, and that's why, you know, we've invested as a city in keeping GM here. And we're hoping that, you know, through this, that they're also able to create a good image out there.
This is the latest in a slew of recalls, and it's worth, for context, I think it's worth pointing out this morning's Detroit Free Press reporters Brent Snavely and Nathan Bomey, quote, CEO Mary Barra is taking a chance that it's far better to act voluntarily than to be forced to do something later. So it's a much more aggressive, preemptive approach to recalls, I guess, if you will, although the headline is interesting. Recalls, is GM going too far?
Well, being proactive, I mean, we talk about that with our police department. We talk about that with our roads. We talk about that with a number of things. Being proactive for GM and making sure that people are driving safe vehicles is extremely important, and this is one of those things.
We're running out of time, but I really want to ask you about the potential layoffs in the Lansing School District. They face a $6 million deficit that it needs to respond to in fewer than 6 weeks. The district's proposing privatizing busing, laying off up to 95 employees, not to mention 60 that are part of the bus privatization plan, although some of those people could go to work for Dean Transportation. What do you make of the challenges facing the school district right now in 2014?
It's always difficult dealing with a deficit and deciding what positions need to be cut. One, I have always been a proponent of looking from the top down. Do you have more chiefs than you have workers? Is there the possibility that there are more frontline people that need to look at being laid off versus the people that are doing the job? Privatization, I'm a strong proponent of unions, and so looking at that in the long run, many times what we've seen with privatization is after it is privatized, the cost goes up and you're out of the business, and then it's too hard to get back in.
Mm-hmm. Carol Wood's been our guest. Carol's a longtime member of the Lansing City Council. We've been talking about the FY15 budget and other issues. Carol, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Wednesday, and it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today, we feature the local effort to raise funds for the funeral and the family of Michael Otto, the pharmacist who was shot to death at the Rite Aid in Frandor last Monday. Rite Aid Pharmacy confirmed to Current State yesterday that it has agreed to donate $10,000 to Michael's family and said it will pay for expenses related to the burial, including transportation back to his home country of Ghana. But there are grassroots efforts in the Lansing community to raise funds for Mr. Otto's family as well. The efforts being led by the Lansing Regional Sister Cities Commission, which has an official relationship with the city of Akwapim in Ghana. And joining me now is Barbara Mason, the commission's president. With Barbara are two of Michael's friends, Dr. Nana Achampong, who is Michael's neighbor, and Kingsley Abuagye, who is Michael's classmate in pharmacy school. Welcome to Current State to all of you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Barbara, how did this fundraising campaign by the Regional Sister Cities Commission get started?
Well, I guess I should say that I probably started it. I was looking around to see exactly what was being done to help Michael's family. We have a great relationship with Ghana, and we've been to Kumasi with delegations several times. And we've had people from Kumasi visiting us. And I was talking to people in the Ghanaian community here, and we really didn't have any ideas to how we were going to fund or they were going to fund his expenses, especially since he had no family in this area. So I thought, well, we've got to do something. And at that point, Rite Aid was not going to be doing anything as far as we knew. I must say that I'm elated that they've decided to donate that $10,000 that's so needed and help to pay with the expenses back home. So we set up a fund with GoFundMe online, and also for people to donate directly through Lansing Regional Sister Cities Commission. In addition, we contacted churches and asked if they would provide funds as well. My church, for example, took up a collection of $500 that we were going to be providing to the family.
Nana Achampong, tell us how you knew Michael Otto. What was he like?
Well, he was a gentleman in the true sense of the word. I got to know him 4 years ago. He's a very close friend of my brother-in-law, who is also a classmate of his. So when I was getting married to my wife, you know, he was part of the American delegation, family delegation in America, who accepted the marriage. And we happened to be neighbors. He even gave us his spare key just in case he gets locked out. So, and we've had a wonderful relationship so far. We are more than friends. We are, you know, it's more like family, because whenever during Thanksgiving, during Christmas, we meet and we just enjoy each other's company. So, you know, and he's always generous, not only with his money, you know, he's generous with his time as well.
Sounds like quite a loss.
Oh, yes.
Kingsley Abuagye, how well did you know Michael? You two attended pharmacy school together.
Exactly, that's true, yeah. I've known Michael back home in pharmacy school. We were classmates, and not just classmates, but true brothers. We happened to travel together in London, too. We happened to live in the same area. Michael and I have been close for a long time. Michael happens to be the godfather of my son, and this is really a true loss. We have lived together as brothers, just like Nana said, on Thanksgiving and all occasions. What we do is we meet together and spend some time together as a family. So I would say Michael has been like a brother to me. He is a godfather of my son. And this is really a terrible loss for
we
the whole friendship.
Very sorry for your loss. Michael had a wife and an 11-month-old daughter. What were his plans, Nana? Did you know? Was he going to bring them to Lansing, or was he planning on returning to Ghana, or do you know?
I really don't know his exact plans. Maybe Kingsley will be able to throw more light.
Do you know?
His plans.
What were his plans with regard to his wife and daughter in Ghana?
He had the intention of bringing them. Michael really likes this place. He was telling me that he chose Lansing for a reason. Lansing is a very peaceful, quiet place, and he had that intention of bringing a wife and child here to live with him, because he really liked this place. And he wanted to live here.
It's extraordinary to hear you say that he felt it was a very quiet, peaceful place, and he should have met his end the way he did. Tell us more about the Ghanaian community in the Lansing area, Nana. How big is it?
It's compared to the Detroit area, it's not that big. It usually comprises of students. You know, so most of the people in the Lansing area have some form of affiliation with Michigan State University or Lansing Community College. You have a lot of graduate students who come and complete their studies, and most of them end up going back to Ghana to work. But for those who work here, or some of us like me who happens to be here for a while, you know, we try to get to know each other and get together during holidays. Yeah, so despite the busy schedule.
Our three guests today on Current State's Neighbors in Action, Nana Achampong, Kingsley Abuagye, who were both friends and acquaintances of the late Michael Otto, the pharmacist who was shot to death at the Rite Aid in Frandor last Monday, along with Barbara Mason of the City of Lansing's Sister Cities Commission. Barbara, how did Lansing's relationship with Ghana get started? You had a hand in that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, when I became a member of the Lansing Regional Sister Cities Commission, we did not have any sister cities in any of the African countries. And that had been an intent prior to my joining. And we began to look for a sister city. Grand Rapids has a sister city that's contiguous to ours in Ghana. And we met with some people there, and they suggested Akwapim South District. So we sent one of our members, Dr. Willie Davis, there to look at the area, talk to the people, and see if it would be conducive for us. And we loved it. We loved the people. They came to visit here, and we really, really enjoyed our relationship with them and signed the agreement with Akwapim South District.
Kingsley Abuagye, does this incident change how you view the Lansing area?
That's a good question. This is a surprise to me, because I also chose the Lansing area because of its peaceful nature as compared to Chicago, because my family is in Chicago, and this is a good question you're asking me. It hasn't changed my perception, because I still can't make any sense out of this act. Someone in between there. I'm just surprised that it happened this way. Hasn't changed my perception, but this is a surprise to me. I would say it's something that we all saying, well, wow, it shouldn't have happened in Lansing, but it is. So,
Dr. Nana Achampong, what about you? Does this incident change how you view the Lansing area?
Yes. You know, it hit close to home, and life will never be the same again. You know, not only when we meet, but even in my daily activities, when I go to the store, he will always be at the back of my mind. And considering that he wasn't out there looking for trouble, he was just doing his work. You know, he was supposed to be in a safe area, you know, and this tragic event happened to him. I still, as much as I would like to treat this as an isolated incident, it's really, you know, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around this whole senseless act. and I don't think life will be the same again.
Have you considered other places to live because of this?
Well, I currently live in Mason. I thought about it. We, you know, it's still the news is still fresh on our minds, and we're still trying to make sense out of this whole issue. So, you know, it might take a while for us to really put things into perspective.
What do you make of America's gun culture? Yeah, are you processing what this country is about and its relationship to guns?
Yeah, obviously, I think there's too many guns in the system, you know, I believe in a person's right to bear arms, but the manner at which you know is controlled, you know, maybe the government can do a better job at legislating laws that can make sure that guns don't get into the hands of those who can use it to cause harm, you know. So definitely, less gun, the better.
Barbara, we're just about at the end of our time. Remind our listeners how they might be able to participate in this effort to assist the Ottos, the Otto family.
There are several ways in which our listeners can help. Number one, a lot of prayers and good wishes to the family. But another is to go to GoFundMe and to provide contributions. The money that we've raised so far has been about $5,000, and that will be added to that which Rite Aid has provided. But the expenses that the family members are going to incur will far exceed that amount that has been collected so far. The expense of sending a child to school in Ghana and to a good school is very high. One might want to know that, and I know the time is going to run out on us, that the parent, the mother and child, had already applied for visas, and they had considered coming to the, Lansing to be with Mr. Otto. The devastation that they must be feeling right now is just tremendous, and the expenses that they're going to incur. Mr. Otto was supporting not only his wife and child, but his parents and some of his siblings. He was a wonderful person, and we need to look at our mental health system as well as our gun laws.
Again, there is a GoFundMe effort that has been launched for Michael Otto and his survivors. You can probably learn more at the Lansing Regional Sister Cities website, I would imagine.
Yes, or go directly to GoFundMe.
GoFundMe. Barbara Mason is the president of the Lansing Regional Sister Cities Commission, which is organizing a fundraising campaign and memorial for Michael Otto, the pharmacist who was shot to death at the Rite Aid in Frandor last week. We've also been joined by two of Michael's friends, Dr. Nana Achampong and Kingsley Abawajie. Thanks to all three of you for joining us today.
And thank you very much for inviting us. And any checks can be sent directly to LRSCC as well.
Thank you. That's our show for today. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.